This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Holiday Powers, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Sanjukta Sundarasan about her new book, Partisan Aesthetics, Modern Art and India's Long Decolonization. Welcome, Sanjukta.
Hi, delighted to be here.
Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Well, thank you, Holiday, for this opportunity to speak about the book. A bit about myself. I grew up, let's say I was born and brought up in India, in Calcutta, in eastern India, where I studied till my bachelor's degree in history. And then I moved to Delhi to complete my MPhil and MA and MPhil in history. And this is sort of important to kind of show the tension between history and art history in my work. So for 7 years, I did history, and then I was increasingly working on artists and trying to relate somehow historical questions with those of, how artists think, how they practice, what intrigues them, what obsesses them. So from my work on 19th century and 20th century graphic satire in my MPhil dissertation, I remember my supervisor telling me, I think it's better you apply to art history for a PhD. And that's what happened. So I applied to University College London, where my supervisor was not a South Asianist, but he worked on early 20th century, Marxism and modernism in the context of the United States. So the project at that point of time was around modern art and politics in India, but primarily it was around left-wing aesthetics. So yeah, that's what happened. And I started my PhD in the UK in art history, working on the left and visual art. So yeah, that's what it has been. And then after the PhD, I moved to the Netherlands, teaching at Leiden University in Asian studies. And in 2021, I moved to art history department in the University of Amsterdam. So that's what it has been. So there is a kind of cacophony of history and art history and what is called area studies in my work. So that's more or less the scope, I think. and in and out of different genres of fields, I would say, and of course, different countries and so on. That's what informs the work. Yeah, yeah.
And so tell us how you came to write this particular book.
Well, partisan aesthetics, to begin with, my thesis was not framed as partisan aesthetics. It was geared towards, back in the early 2000s, I saw this exhibition in Delhi around the works of a now often talked about artist, Chitta Prasad, a communist artist whose works were lost for a very long time. Nobody knew about him other than his friends in, you know, the depths of the party circuits, communist party circuits. But somehow, with the growth of the private art world, the art market in India in the 1990s, his work started coming into the market, steered by certain famous galleries like the Delhi Art Gallery and auction houses and so on. And around 2004-05, they started staging these exhibitions in Delhi, where you would suddenly get into, you know, you will get exposed to a plethora of like a miscellaneous body of material, right? So from political prints to old Hindi film industry posters to different objects. So it's a conglomerate, as it were, of objects. And at the exhibition, I remember seeing works by Chitta Prasad, who I was familiar with his iconography, but not his name that much. And that familiarity came from seeing graffiti in the streets of Calcutta. Calcutta was a communist, was under communist government for 35 years. So the visual iconography of protest I was familiar with, but the artist I wasn't, right? So I saw these works and I wondered why there is no art historical conversation, even historical conversation around this genre of political art, or let's say, political iconography or subversive iconography. So my thesis project began with Chitta Prasad. I thought, okay, I'm going to work on his famine works from the 1940s. But when I started the work, you know, I guess all of us go through this. When you begin the work, you have an idea, and then just it becomes something completely different as you start prodding the material. And I realized that questions of the political, the social, the socialist, whatever we call it, in the 1940s, are basically animating and activating ideas that were there, let's say, from the 1920s. And these conversations exceed the visibility of the artist itself. So the artist itself, in other words, himself, in other words, is a part of a larger potential story. And my project then became trying to give room to what that potential story is. In the thesis itself, it became about dialogues between ideas of, or let's say, shifting notions of modernity in the field of visual art, and also ideas of the people and the popular in politics. So I started looking at how artists from the 1920s onwards, actually. So I expanded, decentered the 1940s, as it were, to both 1920s and 30s and further down into 1950s and 60s. And with that scale, I tried to look at how ideas of political were developing and how the Communist Party in India was trying to capture that space of political art. So that's how modern art enters and deals with this question of the political. So that is what the thesis was on. But these ideas, as I look back and speak, the political comes up as a more sharpened idea. In the thesis itself, I'm not sure how far I managed that, but most certainly while converting the thesis to a manuscript, the book itself, the political really emerged as, how can I put this, a kind of a protagonist, as it were, to how are you going to conceptualize artistic production during a period of political transition. And I then ended up thinking about the idea of partisan aesthetics and the long decolonization. But before I go into that, maybe I could say what really drove the making of the book and finalizing it. Some of the ideas that really became strong in my head was how to foreground visual art as an archive, which is to say not only use art as modes of illustrating other histories, but actually using visual imagination, conversations, and the imaginary itself in the field of visual art as an entry point to think about wider political, cultural, or intellectual histories. So using, entering the field of intellectual history or cultural history through the terms set by the aesthetic. So that's one thing I was interested in doing. The other thing that drove partisan aesthetics as it developed was how to connect the locational, the particular, the regional, with that of the transnational and vice versa. So instead of going with a national story, let's say Indian modernism or Nigerian modernism or Egyptian modernism, so on and so forth, how do we use the particular, the locational story to not only decenter the national, but also show how the transnational, the global, is really filtered into the site of the of a locationally particular site, and how basically the transnational is a local language too, you know. So that is one thing I wanted to capture, and that's very important because as we develop ways of decentering Euro-American or Eurocentric narratives, we, at least in post-colonial studies with the idea of post-colonial modernism, often we are slipping into the nation as a framework of, not slipping into, I think we are holding on to the nation as a framework of thinking about the post-colonial. And this is something that I really wanted to displace, not to slip into the global, but actually to connect what I see as transnational with the locational. So that's one thing. Another critical point would be, at this stage, to highlight that one of the things that drove me, and I really had to learn to be comfortable with this, the idea of contradiction and fragmentation, because when you are working on the idea of political art, you go to your artist or you go to your critic and you want, you look for a stable affirmation of a political ideology, but you don't find that. There is no stability in political affiliation or party affiliation. So the wider idea of a left-wing commitment is a very fluid, ambivalent, rich, nonetheless, mode of affiliation. So, and many of the papers of these people are fragmented, their affiliations are fragmented. So at one point, I had to figure out a way of how to become comfortable with contradictory statements and a fragmented position or a fragmented archive. So one of the ways in which partisan aesthetics had to, let's say, become comfortable in its own skin was to then make contradiction and fragmentation a method. So not use affirmation and celebration, which is often something that dominates art history writing, at least, but really try to develop a room where we, as we write histories of hitherto marginalized areas, subjects, groups, we can really be comfortable with fragmentation and contradiction. So that's one thing. And the last point would be, and that's something many of us are trying to do, and it's a very rich potential there, is how to think in conceptual and theoretical ways about art making from the global south. So how do we actually develop vocabularies of theorizing? What would be those vocabularies? What would be those terms? How can we really develop theories that can speak to multiple sides of the global south? So partisan aesthetics, I'm not saying partisan aesthetics does it, but it's definitely, in my case, it's an opening bid, let's say, towards doing that. So that's more or less something overarching about the book, if you will, you know. So yeah.
And so you come into the book by laying out a lot of these really foundational ideas for what is going to come later on in the book, including the idea of partisan aesthetics itself. Could you describe to us what you mean by that term?
Yes. Like I said, I came to the idea of partisan aesthetics fairly late in the research, and that's important because it kind of had to be wrenched out of that cacophony of contradictions, you know. So partisan aesthetics as a framework is about contradiction. My entry point in the book, so the introduction ended up being very long, and it amazes me now when I try to teach from the book. I always think that, you know, it's hard to teach a chapter without the introduction. So I guess the introduction in that sense sets the stage in more ways than one. My entry point in the book has been the famine, the Bengal famine of 1943, which happened along the eastern frontiers of the Allied Army, the easternmost outpost of the Allied Army in 1943. And it was notorious for being man-made. So it was caused not by absence of food, but a crisis of access to the food. And of course, economists like Amartya Sen, etc., have written about it. His Nobel Prize winning research in poverty and famine in India in the 80s was on the Bengal famine. So the famine for me became an entry point, not as an originary point that, you know, the famine comes and since then art is different. But to me, the famine almost became a kind of hinge to think about how wider ideas of modernity were transforming and how the famine becomes a way of organizing visual thinking. So the famine is also important, A, because it had an impact on visual art. It had an impact on visuality, rather, and how artists and writers and performers grappled with that transformed visuality of hunger. But also because it allowed the Communist Party of India to enter the space of cultural politics in a particular way. And why is that important? It's important because in the 1930s, the party was banned. So as new socialist ideas were spreading in the 1930s, the Communist Party in itself was underground. And it mobilized people through different social cultural platforms. So there is a kind of a passive politics that's going on there. When Germany attacked Soviet Union in the early 1940s, that's when the Communist Party of India enters into this political quandary. They are legalized on one hand because they support the imperial war effort, because in the defense of the Soviet Union, as it were. But at the same time, they are marginalized completely in national politics because they are supporting the British war effort, as opposed to the National Congress under Gandhi, who have the Quit India movement and there is civil disobedience, right? So for the party, it becomes very important to then develop an alternative political, if you will, a political that is not tied to active attack on the British government or the colonial government, but a kind of passive attack. And that space of passive politics is that space of culture. So the famine becomes one way, trigger maybe, that allows the party to develop a space for activism. Social activism, relief work, cultural activism. It reaches out to artists, writers, established cultural figures, even academics, cultural thinkers, if you will, and tries to develop what is called, what has been retrospectively called the Marxist cultural movement. I can talk about that later, but what's important is to understand how the famine becomes what I have called in the book a conjuncture. A conjuncture is most definitely not an originary point, but a conjuncture is a moment that through crisis, via crisis in the Gramscian sense, triggers possibilities, triggers multiple forces to act upon each other. What was interesting to me, of course, this is the 1940s, which is a climactic closing decade of anti-colonial movement in India. And the famine, with its completely different politics, where the left is both supporting the colonial government and trying to develop a wider anti-imperialist a critique at the same point, at same time, trying to develop its own forms of internationalism. And then, of course, 1947, partition and independence, of course. It does, the 1940s anyway is a conjunctural decade. So my point was to see how the famine triggers that conjuncture in a particular way. And I went back to the Gramscian idea of the conjuncture via Stuart Hall, really, to whom a conjuncture is not just a singular moment, but a dynamic of contradictions and difference in the Gramscian line, but it has what he called a circular temporality. So a conjuncture recurs, it recurs across time, it recurs in afterlives through memory, memorialization. So there is a way in which the conjuncture is not just about the singularity of an event, in this case, the famine, but it's also about the circularity, if you will, of its afterlives. So how does this memory of the famine, or let's say the shadow of the famine, keep recurring? So that, to me, the famine was an entry point to also conceptualize that conjuncture. Now, that conjuncture in itself, like I said, generated an aesthetic. It generated an aesthetic by putting pressure on how, what are the values of beauty in art? What is the value of, or let's say, how can the nation be visualized? So, you know, in anti-colonial movements, visualizing the nation is an integral part of cultural imagination. So how is the nation visualized? So it definitely puts pressure on that. There are new values of vision that come up. And some of these things I'm saying because you also see this in art criticism from the period. And also what comes up time and again in the writings on both from the 1930s and, of course, the 1940s is how ideas of how questions of place, location, context, and the everyday would be captured in art. What are the new values of what? And you often see these vocabularies of new nationalism or new sensibilities of truth that critics are trying to develop as they try and understand what is this new aesthetic of realism. They don't want to use the term realism, but they try to nuance it subjective realism or new realism, a lot of vocabularies you see. So that aesthetic, there is an aesthetic dimension to that conjuncture. What's important is to understand this conjuncture did not produce a singular art movement. It produced, let's say, a collective or conglomerate of vocabularies. And how to write about that conglomerate is also something that partisan aesthetics tries to get into. The next point, of course, is that there is a political dimension to this conglomerate. There is a political dimension to this aesthetic. What is that dimension? Though I work with the left and left-wing imagery or left-wing aesthetics, like I said already, finding a singular affiliation became very hard. The closer I looked, I found that there were multiple modalities at play. There was projection on famous artists. There were enlisting of young artist documenters, artist reporters. There were new art collectives that were coming up and joining the Communist Party in certain platforms and rejecting the Communist Party in other platforms. So this kind of vacillation one had to make sense of. So I kind of allowed myself to think about what does being and becoming political mean, even when we talk about aesthetics and the left. So how do we really pluralize and provincialize the idea of the left, if you will? And of course, how these plural modalities of the political shape the wider question of modernism and decolonization. So modernism, the imagination of modernism and modern art during decolonization is one of contradiction. One of difference and not assimilation with the nation state. This is one of the point. So in all these things, the idea of the political really, like I said, emerges as a protagonist. In the book itself, the political did not become the representation of hunger in art, but it rather looking at the historical agency hunger had in transforming and entangling two different threads during decolonization. One is the shifting ideas of modernity in the mid-20th century, and the other is shifting dynamics of left-wing politics, because pre-independence and post-independence, the destiny of the left also changes in India. So really, as a concept, partisan aesthetics does the work of understanding what are the terms, how did art and left-wing politics entangle? So it is that how that partisan aesthetics tries to capture. It's most definitely not about propaganda art. I get called in multiple forums these days to talk about this. Of course, partisan aesthetics has a definite affiliation, a definite meaning in the context, let's say, of East European studies, etc. But I have felt the need to assert at multiple points that it is not about propaganda art or even political iconography or, in art, but my goal is to really give partisan aesthetics a conceptual agency to think about what being and becoming political in art in a particular historical duration can mean. So it is not just the rupture or conjuncture, but the long durée footprints of a transition and how art keeps grappling with that space of the political. So in a way, it really is looking at art and its relation to the temporality of decolonization. And I really hope that the book is picked up by people who are working on completely different locations, but around maybe issues of crisis or transition, political transition, decolonization in this case, and make sense of the political through this. One other point about that is also to see how a specifically local event or a rupture like the famine mobilizes multiple lines of scales of the transnational. So whether that is war, whether that is anti-fascist mobilization, anti-imperialism, transnational solidarities that get activated via the famine and the political culture and the cultural politics it generates. So, you know, in other words, so much to say that partisan aesthetics is a generative term, maybe, to think about what the political could mean in the field of visual arts. So that would be the larger point, I think. But yeah.
So within the book, you have it separated into two major themes. The first, dialogues and dissonances, covers from 1936 to 1953, and the second, post-colonial displacements, marks especially that transition after independence in 47. Can you talk a little bit about the decision to organize in those terms, but also about the organization that does not exactly match up with just pre-independence, post-independence?
The decision, again, this decision was during the writing of the book and not in the original state. And I for those of us who are writing books now, and it's worth noting, I rewrote, I think, 40% of the book because to then really give room to the question of transition. The pre and post independence, I very consciously did not want to organize it in terms of pre and post independence because the transition means different things for different constituencies. For the left, the transition meant not just the arrival into independence, but a fragmentation of the political moment and the cultural moment of the 1940s too. That itself broke, and that had nothing to do with independence. It had all to do with the transformation in international socialist politics, a severely conservative turn that makes many of the former adherents of the movement move away from it. So the same conjuncture of the 40s produces different kinds of, different questions of freedom, as it were. That's something I'm thinking about more. But in the book now, so the part one, which is called Dialogues and Dissonances, basically wanted to give room to this intense period of the late 1930s to the late 1940s, just one decade, and look at what are the different modalities in which left-wing politics and spaces of modern art are converging. And I identified there three modalities, which then organize each chapter in part one. The first one, as you can see, is called Political Potentiality, where you have a set of a set of modernist poets and academics and activists writing on a very famous artist at that point of time, Jamini Roy. And as they write on him, you see new registers of new vocabularies of the social and the socialist in art emerging. Jamini Roy himself is not a communist, but he, I can talk about this later, but he develops this space of integrating modernism, modern art, with the folk, with the and that conglomerate of a folk modern imaginary lends many of the Marxist poets at that point of time, modernist poets and writers at that point of time, to project a certain potentiality of the political on him, where they start talking about how Jamini Roy's art brings about an organic, an integrated, or an organic integration in art, or you know, a socialist revolutionary potentiality in art, so on and so forth. So I track that that space of art critical writing around an artist who is often described as a naive urban scroll painter who has given space to the rural scroll paintings in the narratives of modernism. And that's an established narrative. But you have these writers slowly projecting not only a modernist sensibility to Roy, but also the socialist horizons of that modernist sensibility. And now, in retrospect, when we look at Jamini Roy and some of the most critical writings on his modernism, we often look at these writings, but we are asking completely different questions. So my questions were tied to how these writings are actually the early stages of the development of what would later be called a progressive vocabulary in art criticism, progressive art. So political potentiality is really that what I have called in the book passive participation in the political, where you have writers who are not necessarily affiliated with the Communist Party, but are Marxists nonetheless, most of them, who are projecting these ideas on a famous artist and thereby creating that room. The second chapter is around art as agitator and organizer, which is about more active authorship of socialist vocabulary in art, where by the time already in 1943, the famine has happened, you have artists who are then affiliated, who become members of the Communist Party, and who are then sent to different parts of Bengal to document the famine, so on and so forth. So there is a more kind of active, you know, partisan membership of the communist movement and art that emerges from that, in a nutshell. And then concrete contextuality is the third chapter, where I look at this vacillating affiliation of a new group of artists, the Calcutta group of artists, who come up during the Bengal famine, who say that, you know, our values of modern art needs to capture this space of crisis, the space of social rupture. At times they are with the party, at times they are not. So for me, the first part of the book really is to capture this question of passive participation, active authorship, and vacillating affiliation. So that's the dialogues and dissonances. That's why I called it dialogues and dissonances. Very quickly, the second part of the book, which is titled Postcolonial Displacements, looks at what happens when this moment of dialogue and dissonances dissipates. And that dissipation happens, one could say, after 1947, after independence, but one could also say it happens not only due to independence, but also the left-wing cultural movement, or the left's cultural priorities, political priorities changing. So many of the members of the cultural movement who questioned the completeness of the independence, called for economic freedom, social freedom. Many members of the Communist Party were jailed by late 1940s in India by the Nehruvian government. The movement itself dissipated completely, A, due to incarceration, but also due to the fact that many cultural performers who were happy to align with the left in the 40s as part of a wider anti-fascist kind of anti-imperialist conglomerate found the new Zdanovich turn in the socialist movement global, in the USSR in particular, more widely globally, they found that disturbing and they removed themselves from the party. So the cultural movement dissipates completely. So my question in the second part of the book was then, what happens to socialist art when that cohesive movement is fragmented, displaced. So that's chapter four very quickly, and then five, the last chapter looks at displacements. So the previous chapter was about the displacement of the left's cultural agenda, and the last chapter is how the displacements of the 1940s, both due to the both for the famine and then partition, you know, with large scale the migration crisis, refugees, refugee exodus. So how that appears constantly in the visual imagination of the location, in this case of the eastern part of India, in post-colonial what was West Bengal, and how that imagery of displacement keeps putting pressure on what modernist imagination will come from that location. And sometimes that modernist imagination does not sit well with the national imagination of a post-colonial modernism. So I talk about a disenchantment that is shaped by displacement and how that, you know, so the second part of the book really looks at how displacement and disenchantment not only is a historical, is a question of historical transition, but it's also a question of cultural transition. And if you look at it in that way, maybe one could look at how the idea of the post-colonial itself needs to be displaced, or if not decentered. So that's what the book then methodologically tries to arrive at through these organizations. So I guess part one and part two are meant to then also activate how the partisan is also tied to particularity. Particularity of the story, particularity of the archive, the granularity of a meta story, but also particularity of location that can displace what, displace hegemonic stories, if you will. So that's the, in other words, the logic for organizing it in that way. Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
And if we could just come back to thinking through how what you're doing in each of these chapters, because I think it's really helpful to understand this structure and how you are using this structure really very thoughtfully in terms of how you were engaging with this question really of the post-colonial and what that means. But I also want to make sure to really hear your thoughts and your argument about each of these pieces individually. So I think you described to us for Jaminee Roy this notion that you elaborate of the passive participation of art in the political mobilization of culture. Do you want to add to what you were saying about that?
I guess because, you know, with the growth of art histories from the global south, we often come up with, we focus on particular movements and we foreground them as protagonists of modernism from the area and so on. For example, in the context of Indian modernism, you hear often the story of the progressive artists and the progressive artist groups and so on, who came up very critically in the late 1940s at the moment of arrival into independence. And there is a narrative around their, you know, ideas of secularism, modernism, internationalism, globalism via their art. One of the things that I encountered while working is that once you start moving away from iconic groups or overtly talked about groups, though of course one can do way more than what is being done, of course, once you start looking at the granular details of art critical conversations, you can see a completely different genealogy. For example, the vocabulary of progressive art appears in the 1930s in the context of literature, often as is well known, but in the context of visual art too, as literary critics and writers and poets are writing on, let's say, an artist like Roy. So for me, it became important to take back the vocabulary of progressive to not only to the 30s, but also connect it to a kind of cusp between Marxism and modernism. So modernist writers who are talking about emancipation of form, emancipation of poetry, etc., how they bring that sensibility to thinking about visual art when none of the artists in the field of visual art are actively talking about socialism or Marxism. So for me, that different entry point into lineages or genealogies of politics becomes important. That's also important because often we relate left-wing aesthetics to questions of propaganda. And here you have not propaganda, but a discourse around form. What is going to be the form of socialism, as it were? It's also important that these writings are not by critics, but they are by modernist poets or academics, and how these spaces are gradually infiltrated, seems a negative word, let's say percolated by a new young left-wing activists who try and enlist membership to the Red Book Club and so on and so forth, and how really the organic formation of a socialist aesthetic takes place socially. So more book reviews on socialist politics, more memberships of international socialist organizations, and you see membership growing. None of these people are members of the Communist Party, which in the 30s is underground. So you see a completely different social formation of an aesthetic, left-wing aesthetic, taking place. So that's something I would like to highlight from this book, from this chapter. And particularly, and you know, I sometimes get told that I have not talked about Jamini Roy's art enough, and I feel that, of course, but then people have talked about his art. What we often do not get to talk about is this wider conversation around him. And he's a member of these spaces, you know, he goes and attends all these social gatherings, and he's intrigued by these vocabularies around him. Sometimes he participates, sometimes he doesn't, but he's just happy to see this vocabulary around him. So later, when he's invited by the anti-fascist writers and artists collective to come and speak to their different conferences, he goes at times. But when Calcutta is bombed in 1941-42, then he just stops going. He doesn't leave home. And, you know, while around him, this kind of vocabulary is growing outside. You know, so that space of the tension also between the artist and writing around him, in this case, is something that has value to me, you know, and I hope it will have some value to other people also. I think that's an interesting thing. I would say I would like to highlight the dialogue between modernism and Marxism in the 1930s and early 1940s before there is a more hardening political position in the mid-40s, you know? That's just what I wanted to say. Yeah.
Well, and so then you move into, in comparison, the active authorship of socialist visual reportage in the 1940s. Can you describe that?
Yes, the active authorship, like I said already, is about during the famine, the Communist Party that is legal at that point of time enlisting the membership of young artists, you know, wannabe artists, even performers, etc., writers for sure. And one of these artists that I kind of began this conversation with and my entire research with, Chitta Prasad, is a student in the easternmost parts in the war area in Chittagong, and he is looking at anti-Japanese kind of politics, anti-fascist resistance, and the general secretary of the Communist Party spots him there, brings him to Calcutta and later to Bombay, which is the party headquarters, and then starts giving him these assignments of going to the hinterlands, if you will, and documenting resistance, documenting political protest. Of course, till 1945, while the war was on, the Communist Party, like I said, was supporting the war effort. And the famine then became a way of mobilizing a kind of sensibility of anti-imperialism, anti-capitalism, that kind of vocabulary. And you see Chitta Prasad's works on hunger, not only across the Communist Party's organs, like People's War, etc., but also in his diaries, etc., where he's trying to develop an iconography of hunger. And later he says that, you know, I wanted to do more, but time was of importance and I had to make these quick sketches. And later in life, which is what I do in chapter four later, I can mention that, he tries to develop a more sustainable, long-term, formalist iconography out of that. But in the 40s, it's just haste. Another point of difference in this chapter is that there is a difference between pre-1945 and post-1945 iconography, because in 45, when the war ends, the Communist Party could comfortably change its line from support of the colonial government or the war effort, let's say, to a full throttle resistance. So you see a new kind of resistance vocabulary coming up in 1945-46, where there is a marriage between expressionism, grotesque realism, and this kind of socialist internationalism. So you have workers' movements, Afro-Asian, inter-Asian solidarity movements, etc., being given visual form by an artist like Chitta Prasad and in the pages of what was then People's Age. So it changed from People's War to People's Age, the name of the organ, party organ. And you see these imageries and, you know, one way is to talk about them is to say how working class bodies or peasant bodies are given this kind of radical socialist form. The other is also to look at what international socialist iconography, which is heavily dependent on the image of the worker, in the decolonizing context really picks up the image of the peasant or the image of the, you know, the indigenous figure as an entry point into thinking about what socialist would be. And in the pages of People's Age, People's War, I saw these reportage from different peasant conferences that were happening. And you would often see these clay replicas of the works of Vera Mukhina, as it were, where it is not the worker, but a farmer or a peasant who's rising up with, in that kind of moment of resistance with a hammer and a sickle and so on. So there is a way in which post-colonial socialist iconography can be, the narrative of post-colonial socialist iconography can be developed if we look at these images very quickly, closely. What is important in this chapter is, however, a third, an important point for me in the larger context of the book, is that artists like Chitta Prasad and others, a young Shomnath Hoar, who later became a very famous artist in India, what is interesting is that they suffer from, are made to suffer from, what can be called paradoxes of visibility. So you have party critics writing on all kinds of other artists, but not on them. And developing vocabularies like lower order art and higher order art in the spaces of left-wing aesthetics, where, the party artists, the active authorship artists, are often gatherers of raw material who are doing documentation work. Nobody writes on them. But their art then becomes the founding ground to, basically their task is to provide material to artists of higher order to develop more sophisticated vocabulary. So there is a paradox here. While you have these actively communist artists going and doing this kind of work, they are never written about. They are shown widely in peasant congresses and conferences and so on, in party organs, but there is no art discourse developing around them. That, to me, was an important point. So the celebration of Chittaprasad in the 1990s is a completely different matter. But in the 40s, that was not there, you know. So, or even after, that was not there. So that paradox was important for me to arrive at. Yeah.
So you then move into the Calcutta group and what you describe as the vacillating affiliations to the social and the socialist.
Yep. Yeah. There, it's this slippage in and out of, you know, the slippage of the social in and out of the socialist. So you have a bunch of artists who are very moved by the complete disintegration of the social under famine, millions of refugees coming in, the streets of Calcutta being overrun by, you know, dead bodies and food queues. And you're aware that the root of this famine is a crisis of access. It's this black marketeering and profiteering during the war. So there is a social crisis. You're aware of that. You want to capture that in art. So I open this chapter with this cartoon from that talks about modern art exhibitions in the 1940s, where everybody was talking about, you know, skeletal figures and hunger and so on and so forth, and how that really, you have this figure of a nationalist poet who was famous for idealizing the nation. He's gasping out of his own portrait. He's totally traumatized by the visions of modern art that he sees in front of him, where the nation is not a land of bounty, but a land of death. So many artists, in other words, were depicting this. For me, it was important to really loosen this overarching umbrella use of social realism and really find out the ideological textures therein. So the Calcutta group then, which was a short-lived group really, 1943 to 53, to look at how they engaged with the social and socialist at different points of time. And that chapter really looks at their commentary on realism, on internationalism, on primitivism, even as they try to grapple with that. Calcutta group is also important because they span both sides of the. They are actually one of the first artist groups who really foreground the vocabulary of progressive way before the Bombay progressives. But the group itself had very little unity. Members keep shifting. They themselves, you know, are removed completely from the left by the late 1940s. And they, many of their members look back and reflect on the progressive in different ways. They completely dissociate themselves, or they say, you know, at that one point of time, it was this and that. And you had former members of the, not members, but former figures of the Marxist cultural movement, like Bishnu Day, who's a Marxist poet, writing on them and really capturing this transition in their self-perception. So that transition itself, self-perception, becomes very important in the early 1950s, when you have art critics of the newly independent nation state reflecting on what progressive should mean. So the third chapter really is about changes, tracking the changes in the vocabulary of progressive art from the, let's say, early 1940s to early 1950s, particularly in dialogue with how far the progressive would be removed from its originary kind of roots or lineages in socialism or socialism and modernism, you know, so that, and how the nation state and its visions of a national modernism would gradually begin to dominate the space of progressive modern art, really. So there is so in a way one could say it's a dialogue between the progressive and the national. And that's how I try to capture it in this chapter, through the Calcutta group.
You then move into this theme of post-colonial displacements and the idea of the afterlives of left-wing political art in Nehruvian India.
Yes, sure. That afterlife, like I said, is about what happens to left-wing socialist art after the moment of the high noon of the cultural movement in the 40s. And I look at how artists, this question of dissolution, right? So the question of how when the moment dissipates, the movement kind of disintegrates, people move apart. And people like Chitta Prasad, who I return to in this chapter, become complete loners sitting in one part of Bombay, not engaging with the newly developing spaces of modern art in Bombay, completely disowned by the party, and he himself disowns the party. But then in isolation, he tries to go back to his political imagery from the 40s and trying to develop new aesthetic registers for that kind of socialist iconography. He doesn't get any patronage from the party. He gets patronage from his friends in Eastern Europe, in Czechoslovakia, in the United States, so on and so forth, who send him money, and he tries to develop these albums around, around child labor, around industrial labor, so on and so forth. But he, you know, these are all hardly ever seen, hardly ever shown, till they are discovered much later. So this chapter really tries to show what happens to socialist artists when there is no active patronage, and what kind of socialist imagery emerges out of that pressure of dissolution. What's very interesting in Chitta Prasad at this point of time is that there is a way in which he never leaves Bombay, but at the same time he develops these long-term contacts with the spaces of socialist aesthetic in Eastern Europe, in the United States, so on and so forth. And later in the 60s, his works would be published by the UNESCO for the International Defense of International Organization for the Defense of Children, so on and so forth. But I was very interested in looking at what happens to socialist art in absentia. You know, what is an absent? What do we do with an absent archive? So when he's not visible, what work is being done through in that shielded way? And also an artist like Chitta Prasad, who in that sense is a failure in the 50s and 60s. So what kind of questions can we ask of failure instead of prominence and affirmation, really. Chitta Prasad's works in the 50s, which were never shown, if you plot them, you'll see fascinating works around the international peace movement, around Cold War, around the darker sides of the nation, of the post-colonial nation states, so child labor, the vagaries of industrial labor, landlessness, recurring famines, and he goes and documents them, but then, you know, nobody displays his works. So that dissonance between the zeal of an artist to do this and struggling with invisibility, to some extent self-imposed invisibility. These are the registers that kind of dominate this chapter, and which I try to put in dialogue with a wider art discourse developing in the country, where there is a stress on moving away from socialist kind of actively socialist affiliations, but focusing more on, and this is something that you will see globally, right? So there is a focus on humanism as this kind of almost depoliticized sense of the social, which will then counter a very Cold War ridden vocabulary of socialist art. So you see that in India, which is gains a unique form under Nehruvian socialism, where he goes back, there is a kind of dominance of the image of man, but a depoliticized image of man. Whereas you have former left-wing artists like Chitta Prasad, who also hold on to that image of man, quote unquote, with and struggle with retrieving its political nuances, right? So I look at this, how the idea of the social goes through depoliticization, or how the idea of socialist goes through depoliticization in the early post-colony, in this case, India, of course, in other post-colonial contexts, even in South Asia, it's a very different story. India is quite a unique case here.
So you then end with a last chapter about Calcutta as a new post-colonial site. Can you describe that?
Yes. So the last chapter really is about artists operating in Calcutta in the 1950s and 60s, a site that is hardly ever talked about in conversations around modern art, and with reason, because not much happens. Whatever happens does not enter national spaces of Delhi or Bombay, and artists are often, there is no singular movement as such that is emerging, though there are art groups, there is a struggle around patronage, etc. But when I go to this site and I ask myself, what questions can I ask from this space of marginality without wanting to bring the marginal into the national canon, because that was not my interest at all. I was interested in staying with the marginal and see how the marginal can be a productive site and really allow these obsessions of artists to come out. And one thing I saw was that there was an obsession with the image of hunger, for sure, the image of the refugee, the image of the destitute, or the urban texture as one of disintegration, like a palimpsestic of disintegration and political utopia, because you have to understand Calcutta in the 60s and 70s is very much a place where far left agitation, Maoist politics is gaining ground. So I kind of begin with this undulating image of Calcutta as a city that is, you know, animated by crisis and exuberance and revolution and a texture of life, that a context that's very much pressing upon whatever imagination will emerge out of it. So I called it the aesthetic of displacement by looking at this group of artists who emerged, the Calcutta painters and the Society of Contemporary Artists, who are still around now, the second one. Many of these artists would gain prominence later, but if I stick to the 1960s, which is what I wanted to do, many of them, you see them obsessively returning to the question of displacement and trying to arrive at aesthetic forms that will make them give modernist vocabulary to this very locational experience of displacement. So to me, that obsession and trying to develop an imagery is a very productive ground, rather than identifying a famous artist in that. So to me, that idea of what signature the context and locational particularity then has in dismantling not only the national signature, but also this Cold War division between the social and the abstract. Because many of these artists are genuinely interested in abstraction. They are genuinely interested in abstract imagery, but they grapple with how to remove the social, and they don't want to remove the social. Many of them talk about this pressure of the social, pressure of the subject, so on. One of them said that, you know, this commitment to figurative art is not a negation of abstraction, but it is the twilight zone of ambiguity, which is midway between figuration and non-figuration. This is Paritosh Sen, a very famous artist at that point of time. So he says that he wants to capture the element of plastic violence, the rich saturation of color, etc. So I was interested in looking at how artists were articulating this tension between social and abstract in their own works, while they remain rooted and committed to giving aesthetic form to displacement. So that's something that I tried to do in the last chapter by, you know, staying close to this question of marginality. A marginal site or a marginal idiom in these years, which is the idiom of realism and the idiom of the social.
Well, Sanjukta, we have taken up a lot of your time. Before we sign out, can you tell us what you are working on now?
What I'm working on now, I think I'm still loitering in the 1950s to 70s period. But now I'm moving into the spaces of the transnational. My entry point still will be South Asia. I'll be looking at mainly East Pakistan, so India, East and West Pakistan. East Pakistan later, of course, becomes Bangladesh. So I'm looking at how artists in in the subcontinent engaged with the question of freedom. The freedom in terms of political freedom, independence, but also freedom as liberation, emancipation, so on and so forth, and how they developed aesthetic vocabularies to grapple with the contradictions and dialectics of freedom, as it were. So it's not a well-articulated one yet, but it's all under, you know, I end Partisan Aesthetics with the epilogue is called Towards Aesthetics of Decolonization. So that's what I'm working on, Aesthetics of Decolonization. It is a broader project, but I'm really interested in going deeper into this idea of aesthetics and freedom, knowing fully well that freedom is such a fraught term. So I guess that is going to be my learning process now, so slowly too. But yeah, it's again entering the transnational through the locational, in this case of India and Pakistan. Yeah, I guess that's what I'm working on.
I can't wait. Thank you so much for joining us, Sanjukta.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this. Thank you.